is the Q Report.
Right on time.
Yeah, right on time. 9 minutes late.
1:04 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Broadcasting live from East Williamsburg for the real estate agents, Bushwick, Brooklyn for everybody
else.
For the
rest of us.
I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Patrick Martins.
We're broadcasting live as always. It's Sunday. It must be the Q Report from Roberta's on Moore Street in Brooklyn.
Which just added a cover to the garden up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's beautiful. Every time Dolly, my wife, is here, hasn't been here in a while, and she was amazed at all the great changes going on. It's
on both places.
I love watching people come in because I see a lot of people, young people who live in the neighborhood, they have their parents in for brunch, and they come in here, and there's always this literally audible, like, oh my gosh. People walk through the door because it's really surprising.
Yeah, it's
pretty beautiful
amazing space.
Even as they come through the door and then back into the garden, which is just lovely.
Yeah, the garden's lovely. Apparently, by covering it, they increase the length of their growing season and increase the temperature for the tomatoes.
Which we were talking about how good timing this year for the blight that's going on in the New York State tomatoes for all the rain we've been having, and
that's not good for tomatoes, huh?
No, but it's a good thing that they're growing their own and that they're going to have some supply, so that's good.
So we have a really good show
planned for today. Some interesting people coming in on the phone and in studio.
Well, we have our first guest is going to be a lawyer, Gary Cox.
Gary Cox,
an attorney.
That's a really interesting case. I hadn't heard about it before you told me about it.
It's the he's a lawyer for the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Makes sense what this case is big companies lobby senators or, you know, politicians, and then expect their, you know, non-natural food sources to be, you know, used and accepted as a diet change, you know?
Especially for institutions like, let's say, prisons and schools.
Yeah.
And he's going to, and of course, Weston Price Foundation, which we'll talk about, is involved as well. But it's pretty interesting, actually. The infamous governor of Illinois is involved, as always. Seems like he's like...
Poor guy,
right.
He's like...
Ever-growing scandals, as they should be. He's sort of... It's like, the more you find out about him, the more disgusting it is about him. Blagojevich, specifically, who's not in office anymore. But, yeah, anyway. So Gary Cox is going to be
here. I did feel for him when I saw his name come up as having accepted that. You know, I was like, is it...
I'm sorry. If you accept money from Archer Daniels Midland, what do you expect? You know, it's sort of like, it's grotesque. And, you know, of course, we'll talk a little bit more. Basically, it's a lawsuit against institutional... They essentially replaced soy products that are processed food with protein from meat. And lo and behold, specifically prisoners... began to have horrible health problems, intractable health problems that the institution wasn't prepared for and didn't treat. So the families and advocates being sued for illegal punishment, you know, cruel and unusual punishment, which is of course against the Constitution. So it becomes a constitutional issue. Yeah. Food. Very interesting, you know, the very basic thing that we all take into our bodies.
It connects all things, all conversations. I mean, it's all somehow revolving around food in some way.
It always does.
And then we're going to have Clay Gregory on as a guest, who's going. He works with the
Napa Valley Destination Council,
which is very, you know, if you think about important destination councils, Napa Valley is one of the few recognizable. Regional local names.
It's very interesting too. They talked about that Napa had been the first in the country, and I think it was 68 to be preserved as a. I want to talk to them about this. Preserved as a an agricultural area, which is, you know, I mean, Napa is, I guess, similar to. I would argue the French would be mad about this, but the Bordeaux region or the like, or Champagne, etc. In that sense, that it's very specific and ideal for agriculture. So. Boy, if California ever has a problem for agriculture, we're in big trouble in this country, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, we do get a lot of stuff from them, don't we?
It's quite ideal, their climate, and it's very specific, their microclimate. So we're looking forward to talking to Clay, and glad he's going to be here.
It's amazing how variant the climates are in this country. I mean, it's such a big space. You have hardcore desert, super wet.
Yeah, we have everything here. We really do. Mountains and what we don't have, I guess, up in Canada they have tundra. We don't have tundra here.
We don't have frozen tundra.
That's it, though. I mean, that's about it.
We probably used to in Montana until not too long ago.
Probably North Dakota and northern Michigan. It's possible.
It's so cold there, it might as well be a tundra.
I like it that way.
So, and then we're going to do a few obituaries.
Yeah. Some very prominent people have died. Corazon Aquino, the people's leader. Most famously, the People's Revolution. My wife is here to talk about it. She was Filipino. She was there at the time. She was there at the time that it had happened, and she's going to talk about that revolution. It's very interesting. After Marcos was defeated and theoretically, although we don't know, assassinated her husband, and she was... popularly ran for office because the outcry was so large, but we're going to talk about that.
Wasn't it true that in reaction to the previous administration, she only wore one pair of shoes for her entire rest of her life?
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's official or not.
we'll hear about that. Although Doily, my wife Doily, talks about, people being disappeared, and her sister was very politically active, and her parents were always scared about her not going out to a protest and never coming back again, And, of course, they were supported by most of the regimes in the United States. And
we take that for granted, don't we?
Marcos was supported most, obviously, by, in his final terms by Reagan, and went into exile in Hawaii, which, of course, going into exile into whatever country you're is the ultimate, responsibility. It's like when Pinochet went into exile, or when the Shah went into exile in France, the same kind of thing. So it's very interesting. And also... In our own country, we lost a legend this week, mm-hmm. at least for the Generation Xers that we're a part of, Patrick and I. That Patrick, are you Generation Y? I'm Generation X, technically. Are you Generation Y?
I'm my own unique generation, born and raised on the Upper East Side.
You are, but John Hughes,
big.
It's incredible. I mean, when you look back at the list
he holds up the underwear in the bathroom... everyone's like, oh.
I mean, maybe you've seen Ferris Bueller's Days Off, uh-huh. Weird Science, Pretty in Pink, Vacation, Home Alone. Just a few of the movies he directed or produced or wrote. I mean, he's a legend. And wasn't that young, relatively speaking, 59 years old, died of a heart attack. So we're going
to... Did he do The Count of Monte Cristo?
I don't know. It's maybe a reversion of that. He it's funny because he really captured. I remember him being as a teenager watching his films, just thinking like it's exactly what high school was like. And he always said he never had a troubled childhood. It was very happy, uh-huh. which is funny. So
and Molly Ringwald was his big muse.
Yes.
Well, we should take a break and then we will come back with Gary Cox and talk about a very important issue from a very important foundation in America.
I look forward to it.
here we are back on the Q Report. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Mark Marabella.
We're brought to you, sponsored today by Paradise Locker Meats. And we have our first guest, Gary Cox, who should be on the telephone. Gary, are you with us?
Hi, how you doing, Patrick?
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for making some time to talk with us today.
Sure, not a problem.
Well, could you maybe just from your mouth tell us a little bit about the Western A. Price Foundation, and then we would go into talking about this court case, but just to give people a little background?
Well, sure. Weston A. Price was a physician from the United States who went around the world and documented the eating and health habits of various indigenous tribes, and he found that the diet that those indigenous tribes consumed was much better for their health. He specifically looked at their dentition and other critical components, heart rate, blood pressure, all this kind of stuff, disease, and found that their diet was much better than the Western diet, which consisted of processed foods, white enriched flour, refined sugar, and all this kind of stuff. Sally Fallon, who is the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, started this organization, I believe, in the 90s to promote traditional diets and traditional foods for people to improve their health. So the Weston A. Price Foundation is a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. that really promotes nutrient-dense, healthy food for people.
Hey, Gary, this is Mark Marabella, I'm co-host. What is nutrient, if you can just put a little more definition, what is nutrient-rich food exactly versus non-nutrient-rich food?
Sure. If you look at, let's say, the white bread that's out on the market, it doesn't have very many nutrients in it, but it does have a lot of calories. So if you eat a sandwich that has, let's say, white bread in it, your stomach's going to be full. Your body's going to get the calories it needs, but it doesn't necessarily get all the nutrients it needs. Contrasted with
nutrients being what exactly?
Yeah, vitamin A, vitamin D, potassium, calcium, niacin, all these other nutrients, which is found in leafy green vegetables, fresh fruits rather than fruit juice, and so on and so forth. So that's what we mean when we say nutrient dense. You may have a food substance that gives you 100 calories, but it gives you all the nutrients you need, rather than something that gives you 100 calories with no nutrients.
It's similar in such a way people might think they're eating something healthy like white bread, but like a candy bar or even maybe liquor, there's a lot of calories but no nutrients in that way.
That's exactly correct,
as
Mark,
an analogy.
Right.
Okay.
And so tell us about then how this translates into this cruel and unusual punishment lawsuit regarding the soy diet for Illinois prisoners.
Sure. We've brought suit against the state of Illinois because what they have done is they have substituted soy for, like, soy meal and soy products for real meat, for real cheese, and for real other food that has, you know, substantial amount of protein in it. And the FDA, back in the 90s, I believe, came out with a warning that said as long as somebody consumes less than 25 grams per day of soy, then that should be fine. But if you consume more than that amount, you may suffer some adverse symptoms. So what we have found is these prisoners in the Illinois prison system are actually being forced to eat at least 8, sometimes more, servings of soy on a weekly basis. And we believe that the inherent amount of soy that's in the foodstuffs that the prison cafeterias are offering the prisoners is actually leading to adverse health effects on the prisoners.
So Gary, this is Mark again. Tell us, for people who, you know, may be listening and think, oh, well, what's wrong with my soy and my my soy chicken and my soy milk? What's wrong with that? I mean, or edamame. Tell us, there's a distinction between good soy, bad soy, or is it just a matter of the amount or how it's processed?
It's really the matter of the amount. That is my understanding. I'm not an expert. I'm not a physician. I'm just the attorney mouthpiece that's, you know, representing these clients in this case, but it's my understanding that it really does go to the amount and how the soy is processed. There's some good books out there. Kayla Daniel, for example, a PhD who wrote this book called The Whole Soy Story, she explains, the health disadvantages of consuming too much soy.
So you said there's a lawsuit. Who? How did it start, and where has it gone, and where is it at today?
Sure, it's actually got a very interesting history. An inmate by the name of Larry Harris, who has been confined in various facilities there, noticed that he was having problems after he ate certain foods at the facility. For example, like a burrito or some macaroni and cheese that would have the soy meal in it instead of real meat or real cheese. He did some investigation and some research, and he discovered the Weston A. Price Foundation.
Hmm.
And on the Weston A. Price Foundation's website, he started researching, you know, the effects of soy. And when he found out about that, he contacted the Weston A. Price Foundation, got some more information, read some scientific journal articles, and came to his own conclusion that it was the soy in the food that was actually causing him his injury. So he was the first one who filed suit against the state of Illinois. Other inmates found out about this, and they started conducting their own individual research as well, and they came to the conclusion that, yeah, you know, I've had my thyroid removed. For example, one of our plaintiffs has had this happen. Another inmate has had a heart attack because of, you know, the increased soy levels in the food and the diet. So these other inmates separately started to file suits as well, until there were at least three separate lawsuits before Judge Harold Baker in the Central District of Illinois. At one point, the Weston A. Price Foundation approached me and wanted to know if I would be willing to represent them, and I said yes. So what Judge Baker did is he consolidated all of the cases, and he gave me enough time to file what we call an amended complaint to actually bring all the claims together, and that's what I did back in June. Is I filed an amended complaint on behalf of eight plaintiffs, and we have now sued a total of 36 defendants. Some of those are individuals, like some wardens and some physicians, and then some of those defendants are actually the state of Illinois and its two agencies, the Illinois Department of Corrections and the Department of Central Management Services.
So how do they make the connection between, well, first of all, describe what ailments the first gentleman had, and how did he make that jump, and how did he even find out in prison that it was soy replacement?
Sure. Larry did a lot of investigation, and he uncovered some contracts between the state of Illinois and Archer Daniels Midland, and it was ADM that is actually supplying this soy product. And he looked at the contracts and what the specifications of the contracts were, and it says right in there what the amount of grams per serving is of certain, you know, like burritos or cheese or whatever. Larry actually a couple of times went into anaphylactic shock after he consumed some of these meals, and in fact he now has a pacemaker in his heart because of the misdiagnosis performed by the physicians who worked there at the facility.
How old is he?
Larry, I believe, is about 48 years old. Yeah.
Relatively young, then.
He's relatively young, and other inmates have had other symptoms. For example, one of our plaintiffs has stenosis, which is, as I understand it, it's a hardening of the heart, and the heart is less flexible. It becomes more brittle, and it can lead to a heart attack. A lot of our plaintiffs have IBS, which is called irritable bowel syndrome, which is basically a bunch of you know, cramps and diarrhea and pancreatitis that they suffer. Other inmates have constant colds, runny noses, rashes on their arms and all over their body.
So,
another inmate is getting these like stalactites in his stomach. Which is, you know, causing a lot of pain. So I guess, you know, to put it together, we're obviously going to have to prove our case in court, but we believe we've got some journal articles and some competent expert testimony who can testify to these symptoms are caused by an excess consumption of soy in the diet.
And how do you go about with this lawsuit? I mean, who, what court do you approach? You know, what type of, you know, now that you have all this information, like, what are the next steps? And are there other states that are also feeding their prisoners or students soy, and that this case could be generalized to?
Yeah, sure. I'm not aware of other states, and then I haven't had time to focus on other states. But in Illinois, these prisoners filed their original complaints in the United States District Court for the Central District of Illinois. And when I filed the amended complaint, I, you know, of course, filed the amended complaint in the same court. So all of these cases now have been consolidated into one case before Judge Harold Baker in the Central District of Illinois. We have served nearly every single one of the defendants in this case. Some of the defendants are private individuals who work for a company called it's Wexford Health Services, I believe, and they are on contract with the Illinois Department of Corrections to provide medical care and medical treatment for the inmates. We've served the Wexford defendants, and we've almost sued every single one of the state defendants. Wexford has until August 15th, I believe, to file their answers or other type of responsive pleading. The state defendants, however, they would have 21 days after the last defendant is served before they have to file their answer. So we're in the very infancy of this case before formal discovery has really been performed, before depositions have been conducted, or before, you know, we've exchanged the documents and interrogatories.
So Gary, did you have any prior... did you have any prior knowledge of this sort of situation? Did you? I'm sure you did research of it, even if it's not in other states. I mean, because to you know, just on the face of it, you'd think, well, I mean, who knows what he could have a thousand. The idea of relating it that to you know too much soy is a very interesting proposition. Of course, is the case in many cases. But if you're coming at it like purely dry, you get a phone call. What was sort of the sense of discovery for you that you found like, wow, this is you know this has some legs to it?
Well, obviously, I believe it has some legs to it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have taken the case.
Right, right. What convinced you? What did you find other research or cases or?
I've read some of the scientific literature that's out there. I've been in correspondence with some of our expert witnesses by email, and they've given me their expert opinion based on studies that they've done, the toxicity of soy at very levels, the amount of soy you need to consume. I've looked at the FDA website and looked at some of their research that they've issued on soy. And then I've also talked to every single one of the plaintiffs in this case, and I've you know discussed with them on the telephone what their symptoms are, how they feel, have they gone off of a soy-free diet for a while and bought their own food at the prison commissary, and did that change, their bodily symptoms, how they felt,
and did it mostly?
Actually, yeah, it did. We have one guy who was off soy for a while. He's actually made himself a guinea pig. And so we're going to actually compare before and after. What was his, you know, vital signs before he went off the soy diet, and what were his vital signs after he went back on to the soy diet? So,
and what are your goals with this case? I mean, is it just to get the Archer Daniels Midland soy out of prisons, or is it to actually change the diet and maybe bring in local farm foods? I mean, how far are you going to take a victory over the importance in diet, you know, to any human being?
Right. And in this case, we just want an injunction from the court that prohibits the use of soy in the prison general population diet. That's the main goal here, because we are getting constant letters from other inmates who also wish to join in on the suit. And I feel sorry for Judge Baker in the sense that he's being flooded with requests to join the suit. He gets letters from inmates all over the Illinois prison system asking, you know, please, can you let me join the suit? And
incredible.
He files all these with the court, and he dutifully, you know, notifies me that these letters have been filed. And so Yeah, we've got a lot of people who are really interested in this, and if we can just get soy out of the prison system, that'd be a huge victory for these guys.
Gary, this is Mark. We have about 30 seconds left. I just want to ask you one question. In our research, we found that, and I don't know if you can make this this leap or if this is just circumstantial, it doesn't seem to be in a political situation, but Governor Blagojevich, the same governor of Illinois who resigned in scandal, was known to have accepted ARM, Archer Daniels, ADR, excuse me, ADM, Archer Daniels Midland money for the campaign. Did those two things coincide in the sense of them changing the diet? Was there a before and after? Or is that just sort of a detail that's apart from the investigation and the lawsuit?
I think we'll find that out through discovery.
Mm.
And if we do find out something like that, it could have a motivating effect on the state.
Mm. Is the timeline working, at least at this point, meaning did these inmates have a good diet and health prior in some manner, and then afterwards, meaning they can sort of peg it to a date or in there around or something like that?
Or not to another cause, perhaps,
right, exactly.
Outside completely.
Right.
Well, right. That's obviously what the state of Illinois and Wexford is going to try to prove that, you know,
very
it's a pre-existing condition. Yeah.
And, you know, is it diet? It always comes down to that. You know, they're like, there's a new paint or whatever, but it most always is down to the food.
And in this country, too, people don't think of diet as often as a source. And, of course, it's the primary thing that
it's
we
everything.
Bring into our bodies. Gary, thank you so much for coming on. And we hope
to be the inaugural, you're the Virgin Weston Price Foundation guest. We hope to have many other guests from that organization on all our shows.
And we hope to have you back on, Gary, to give us updates, please. And, please come back and tell us update what's going on.
And we'll serve you some animal fats if you come, some lardo, some cured meats
from
heritage foods.
Yes, we're eating delicious greasy pork as we speak. I love
thanks for the opportunity, guys. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks,
okay.
Gary.
All right.
And we will come right back.
That's pretty amazing. They're being forced to... Clay Gregory talking about Napa Valley.
Yeah, we'll come back. But right when we come back, we'll cut to break right now. But we'll summarize what just happened. Very interesting
Great.
Story.
Coming back to the Q Report.
We're brought to you by Paradise Locker Meats in Trimble, Missouri. Great place to slaughter your cows or pigs or goat to buy food.
Yeah, they have a little deli section there, sort of, don't they?
I'm trying to convince them to get into sandwiches and stuff, more for personal reasons, because I have to go out there four times a year.
It's delicious. Everybody in Missouri should visit if you're nearby.
And they, good, honest food. I mean, it makes so much sense, the Weston Price Foundation and the importance of this lawsuit.
Yeah.
I mean, these are basic truths that many people knew all along, you know? It's just, I guess, I don't know why food would be so underappreciated or undervalued.
Money and politics, you know, it seeps into everything. The idea that these prisoners are being forced to eat unhealthy amounts of what in the FDA, in the FDA's own language, are listed under more than 200 poisons given by an excess of soy.
Yeah.
And people should be careful. You know, if you're eating your soy milk and your soy products, and you think you're getting, you know, your bean curd is replacing your protein, it's not, folks. So search for yourself. Don't take our word for it. You know, do your research. But, you know, meat is important to the diet.
As is wine.
Protein.
As is wine, yes. Which is, you know, pleasure, basically.
Yes.
A total puritanical outlook never seems to really be the way to go, you know? I mean, everything in moderation. Wine's very important. And we have a very great guest for the second half of the show. Clay Gregory was actually, without his word and energy, Slow Food's first congresses that brought all the chapter leaders together, the first one of which was in Bolinas, California, would not have happened without Clay Gregory, you know, explaining to the Mondavi family, Robert Mondavi family, the importance of Slow Food, why this could be good. So he actually made it possible that about 200 of the first Slow Food founders could meet in a place and then go back to their locales and really blow it up. So and then he worked with a friend of mine, Chris Carpenter, who, you know, was the chapter leader for the Napa Valley of Slow Food. So, Clay, are you with us?
I am, Patrick, and it's great to hear your voice and to be on the show. I listened to a whole bunch of the old shows over the last couple of days, and you guys are doing great, great work.
Fantastic. And as are you, tell us about this new gig of yours working for the region of the Napa Valley.
Yeah, I'm the president of the Napa Valley Destination Council, and what our aim is to bring visitors to the Napa Valley at the less busy times of the year. So not to just get more people here, we don't have an interest in that, but on the periods of time from Sunday through Thursday during the week is quieter, and of course in the winter is quieter, and so we're trying to manage what they call destination marketing so that we have the kind of people who love Napa Valley wine and who love Napa Valley restaurants and Napa Valley hotels and bring them in when we already have room for them. So that's what I'm up to.
That's great. Is everybody listening? Sundays to Thursdays, that's the hot deal, and no crowds, right?
That's exactly right.
And what strategies are you using to convince the visiting public to kind of change the traditional itinerary of zipping up there for the weekend?
Well, I think it's what Mark just said, is that there's an attractiveness to be here when there are fewer people. Napa Valley is a very small area. I think people assume that it's larger because it's got such a sterling reputation in the world of wine and in the world of visitation, but it's only about 35 miles long. Well, you've been here, Patrick, but it's only about 35 miles long and about 2 to 5 miles wide. So it's a small area, which to me is one of the attractions. It's very easy to get from one spot to another. And within that, we have an incredible amount of diversity, not only from a wine-growing standpoint, but from a restaurant standpoint and an agriculture standpoint. But when it's quieter, you know, people have more room to move around, and that's always nice. People like that.
I hope they don't ever. We've been there several times, and I was just hoping. Last time we were there, it was a little. I think we stayed a week, and we were there during some of the the slower times. But I was just hoping it's sort of like the Hamptons that they never, you know, increase that 2-lane highway bigger than that, because it'll just be ruinous, I think.
And then actually, you guys just have Highway 29 and then the Silverado Trail, right? Are your two main.
That's it, exactly. Yeah. Well, one of the really good things that happened back in 1968, some very people way smarter than I am, led by Jack Davies, who brought Tramsburg back to life, you know, one of our finest sparkling wine producers. They got past the first agricultural preserve, and it was in 1968, so there are over 400,000 acres of land in the Napa Valley that are protected by the Ag Preserve. So if we hadn't had that for the last 40 years now, in downtimes for the wine industry, you know, there would have been a lot more roads and buildings and a lot fewer undeveloped land and a lot less land for agriculture. So from that standpoint, we're very well protected.
Could you tell us a little bit about the history of the Napa Valley? I mean, for people that don't know, I mean, from as far back as you find interesting, but it's a very interesting region. I mean,
it goes pretty far back, actually.
Yeah.
It does go far back. Well, the name Napa is a Native American word from the tribe of Indians who lived here, which were the Wapo tribe. And in fact, as an aside, the hill that Robert Mondavi lived on and that his widow, Margaret Beaver Mondavi, still lives on, they call Wapo Hill. Which a lot of people think refers to something other than Native Americans, but it's
like,
not
like
true.
My heritage, okay. Italian Americans, yes.
There you go.
We're embracing it. We're embracing it.
So, but in the mid 1800s, the first vineyards were planted in the valley, and the first winery was Charles Krug Winery, which is still here, of course, owned by the other side of the Mondavi family. And that was built, I think, or opened in 1861. So there's been wine industry here for a long, long time. And if you look at some of the older materials from the late 1800s and early 1900s, there are great certificates and medals won in Paris and in London for Napa Valley wines. But then, of course, in 1920, we had the ill-fated era of Prohibition. So the wine industry pretty much went away. There were still wineries around that made wines for religious orders. And interestingly, throughout Prohibition, and this is surprising to me when I think back on it now, but it was legal for households to make their own wine for consumption. So vineyards in Napa Valley still grew and shipped grapes to other parts of the country. But that obviously was not nearly enough to keep the wine business healthy. So it went into a much more quiet period, really until the 1960s, when Mr. Mondavi left Charles Krug, Robert Mondavi left Charles Krug, and started Robert Mondavi Winery. That was the 26th winery in the valley at the time, and now we have right around 400. So
what was unusual about his move to Robert Mondavi Winery? Like what did he do with that winery that made it such a seminal move?
That's a great question, Patrick. He had a vision that Napa Valley belonged in the company of the great wine regions of the world. And he didn't want to just kind of be content with doing things the same way that they had been done. So he visited every great wine region of the world, and he came back with learning from Burgundy and from Tuscany and from Bordeaux, and brought, you know, much more of a keen belief that this region had the what it takes from a climate and a soil standpoint to make wines that would be talked about in that kind of a company. And nobody really had that faith or that vision about Napa Valley up to that point. And he also did something that we try to continue today throughout the valley, I think, much more so than most other areas. And that was that his belief was that first and foremost, we should be talking about wine and about California wine and about Napa Valley wine and not be talking about our own individual brands. Mm. So he was about working together, you know, with the old adage that as the tide goes up, all the boats go with it. And we think we still try to follow that example today.
It is great vision. I mean, and it really is thought of as such. And that's a great bridge. Clay, I wanted to talk about the macro environment of Napa, because of course it's bordered by Sonoma and other places now. And tell me about the larger view. Are there other things grown there? Because I know, of course, if anybody knows about growing wine and having visited the Mondavi vineyards, that of course sometimes they plant various crops to add flavors, like, you know, whatever, berries, etc., on the ground. Are there other things grown there? And talk about sort of the region larger than beyond Napa.
Sure. Well, Napa Valley grows things beyond grapes, but it's predominantly grapes. We have a very Mediterranean style climate, so we also grew a lot of olive trees, and there are many olive oils produced in the Napa Valley. There are small dairies that make cheeses of various kinds in the Napa Valley. On the Sonoma side, where they actually border the Pacific Ocean, there are a greater number of dairies, and they have a whole seafood supply that obviously ends up in Napa Valley very frequently as well. Mm. But it still is a very nice agricultural area, even though we're close to, you know, one of the world's great cities in San Francisco. More and more, there are local farmers. We now have two farmers markets every week in Napa. So there's lots of regional growers. We have a new. Have either of you been to the Ferry Plaza Market in San Francisco?
Yes.
Yeah, now you guys have your version of the Ferry Plaza.
The Oxbow Market.
Yeah.
And that was actually put together by Steve Carlin, who put together the Ferry Plaza market as well. So
my buddy Taylor at Fatted Calf and Tomas from Early Roti, both of which buy Heritage Meats, they have both set up shop in Oxbow.
Patrick, I was in the Fatted Calf just yesterday.
It is so good what he does, the diversity of stuff, and also the diversity of stuff at Oxbow.
Yeah.
You could truly spend a day there and have a great time.
Indeed. So there's a lot of, you know, it's a small part of the world, but it's a very special place, I think, predominantly because there's such a mix of being right next, basically right next to the Pacific Ocean, right near San Francisco Bay, and then a tremendous diversity of soils because we have marine sublayers from the Pacific, but then there's also been a tremendous amount of volcanic activity here, and of course we are prone to seismic activity, so the ground has been shaking for millions of years as well.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, now that you're with the Valley and not with the winery itself, you know, what is the spectrum of, you know, quote-unquote slow wines versus big wines that have really industrialized and commoditized the process? Or has it remained a kind of brotherhood that, that each person is aware of their role or their environmental footprint?
Well, it's that's an, a great question. There's all this publicity around the consolidation of the wine industry because there are large companies now, like Constellation, which owns Robert Mondavi now, and Diageo owns Beaulieu Vineyards and Sterling Vineyards, and Foster's is a large Australian company that owns Beringer and some other famous wineries as well. But what gets lost in that is that there are still far more family-owned wineries and small wineries than there are wineries that are owned by large companies. There are about 300, there are a little over 300 members of the Napa Valley Vintners Association, and more than half of them produce less than 5,000 cases each.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you some idea of the fact that there are so many, many small family wineries, and that's true both for Napa Valley and Sonoma as well.
Clay, I was wondering if you could give just a, for those who don't know, just a little background on growing in general. Sort of what you said, Mediterranean climate, but tell the listeners what is ideal for the grape and why doesn't it have to be rotated like corn has to be rotated to soy to wheat, etc.
Well, the climate here is it works for grapes because of the Pacific Ocean and the San Francisco Bay. Without those two really cold bodies of water, it would be too warm here for grape wine. We could grow grapes, certainly, but it wouldn't have the right kind of length of growing season to leave the fruit on the vines long enough to get really good character and texture. Because we're at the same latitude as Sicily, so and Sicily makes wine for sure, but it's not, you know, wine among the world's greatest.
Right.
And so the way that this works, and it's fascinating, and hopefully it'll work.
It's interesting, because I always remember it as being very hot and dry, arid, and you're talking about it being very sort of moist or somewhat moist and cool.
Well, it's both, and that's why it works. What happens is, and hopefully we can make this work on the radio, the Central Valley, you know, is the big valley in California, the San Joaquin Valley.
Right.
And that's very dry and very hot. And so what happens in the summer is the hot air from the Central Valley rises, and it creates a vacuum, and that vacuum pulls in cold air from the Pacific Ocean, and on its way to, you know, going east, it lands in the Napa Valley. So this morning, even though yesterday it got up to about 90, this morning it was in the high 40s, low 50s, and we had a blanket of fog over at least up to Yountville, I'm sure. I'm in Napa proper, and we were covered in fog.
It's so amazing about out there.
You can never judge the weather by its cover.
50-degree difference. It's incredible, yeah.
Yeah, because you're covered.
You have to bring a fleece and linen at the same time.
Well this famous, was it, who said that?
Mark Twain.
Coldest summer, or my, what's that?
Coldest winter he ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Right. Oh,
exactly. So you see all the tourists on the Golden Gate Bridge in shorts freezing to death because they think that it's like, you know, Southern California.
I always like to say
not.
I've bought like more Gap sweaters in San Francisco.
Like, realizing that's where the fleece is. It's like you'd really need it.
Well, this has been great. I mean, Clay, this is a network that's friendly to the issues that you find so important. So if you ever have any story ideas, please come back and stay a frequent guest with us, we hope.
Oh, I'd love to. And I do. Do I have one quick minute?
Sure.
One of the things that we didn't talk about that's been really, really important, and the grape growing community is really behind it, is the whole environmental idea. And in Napa, there is a program that the vintners have helped put together with other people, and we have two green certified programs, one for grape growing and one for winemaking in the winery. And Yvonne Chouinard, who started Patagonia, mm-hmm. when he saw that what the vintners had put together for the Napa Green Program, he said, "I've been at this for 30 years, and this is the best, most well-thought-out program I've ever seen." Hmm. So I know that topic is near and dear to hopefully most people's hearts now, and I just Absolutely. Want to make sure that was on the show.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, Clay, thanks so much for joining us on this Sunday. Keep on keeping on. We hope to have you back.
I certainly hope so, and maybe one day I'll get to see you guys in New York and come to the studio.
In studio is the best.
The studio, you'll be surprised. It's a really interesting spot.
It sounds like it.
Well, Clay, nice to hear your voice, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you both so much. Patrick, good to catch up.
Yeah.
Thanks, Clay.
Bye-bye.
Well, we are going to come back with two big obituaries, Corazon Aquino and John Hughes.
Stay with us. Welcome back at the Q Report.
Q Report stands for quotidian.
That's right. We haven't said that this hour.
It's Le Pain Quotidien is a place. It's everyday bread.
Everyday. Everyday culture in our case. The Q Report.
The mundane, you could almost say. It's so overlooked. It's
so overlooked. It may be mundane, but of course it never is. The details are always more fascinating than at first glance, as the show points out.
That's where the richness of life comes, the fabric of life. You know, that's what there is to talk about.
Exactly. Coming up, speaking of life, there's also death. And one of the blocks, if for those faithful listeners out there of the Q Report, we are introducing some blocks. We have a doc block. We're going to have we have the obits section. We're going to have New York waterways. And so
that's these are waterways.
Waterways. We're going to have, forgive my stammering.
That's what 11 mimosas does to a man.
Yes, come here for the market for the. They're very special, the Bloody Marys here. You should dab them. They're different than anywhere else. But we want to talk about Corazon Aquino, who was the leader of the Philippines, recently died. And we have a guest in the studio, my beloved, lovely wife, Doily Reyes, who grew up under Marcos, and he could talk about that, and then the change to the People's Revolution. So, Doily, welcome to the studio.
Hi.
Hey. When were you born, Doily, if we could ask? Or who was, how many years of the Marcos administration did you live under?
Well, Marcos declared martial law in 1972, and I was 2 years old at the time.
Hmm. And so you lived under martial law for quite a while.
Yes, I did.
So tell us about your sister. I remember your parents being afraid of your older sister going out, and she was very politically active. What would happen to people if they talked about the administration, the Marcos administration?
They usually disappeared.
Yeah, like something would happen to them.
My dad used to always say not to talk bad about Marcos when I was a kid, because you can basically, like, the police can take you and you can just disappear.
How do they come? Just in the middle of the night with guns?
Well, there was it's a martial law, so we had
curfew.
We had a curfew for like at 12 midnight.
And what happens if you were out past that?
They could take you. They will take you and take you to jail, and you can spend a night there.
So what did Ms. Aquino, President Aquino, mean in terms of how did she facilitate the transition from martial law to a democracy?
Well,
we'll talk about Benigno,
her husband. We had an election. Well, there was an election coming up, and Benigno Aquino was, he was exiled in Boston, and he was actually teaching at Harvard and I think MIT. And his family didn't want him to come home, but he wanted to because he wanted to run against Marcos after 20, I think it was 21 years or 22 years that he's been president. So he came back, and at the tarmac, before he came down, he was coming down the plane. They shot him right on the chin, and it was about the bullet was about pierced through his head, and it was about the size of a quarter. And he was laying in state that way, like, you know, like it was the same thing as JFK. Jackie Kennedy wanted people to see what they did to her husband. Huh. And Corazon Aquino did the same thing.
Interesting. And Marcos, of course, denied any responsibility, although it was his soldiers that killed him.
Yes.
So tell us what happened then. So he was killed. The country was in a state. And, of course, Marcos was unanimously...
There was going to be an election anyway. Right. And so the people had asked Cory Aquino to run against him. And she didn't want to run. And she said she was just a housewife and she didn't know how to run a country. But there was a petition that was signed. And it was like millions of people who signed the petition. So she basically said that, if there's an X amount of, you know, signatures that I get, then I will do it. And she did exceed the, I can't remember how many
you needed
signatures.
It's now, back then,
unbelievable. Millions of physical signatures they got. It's incredible.
I was just going to ask, how was the, it makes it sound like a grassroots activism.
Totally.
Did people communicate? Did you guys have a Walter Cronkite? Was it the radio? How were revolutions fomented?
I lived in a town outside. I grew up in a town outside of Manila, right outside of Manila, which is about 20 minutes from Manila. It's like Brooklyn to Manhattan. And, there, you know, like small towns like that, we had basically like this sort of a grassroots. They would gather in like, you know, a piazza, and like all the people would be there. And that's how they gather signatures. And
so she got it and she ran.
Yeah.
And she ran with no pretense about who she was and what she promised.
Yes.
Did she deliver on what she promised, or was it too impossible to deliver on all the claims she
made?
When
she became president?
Yeah.
Well,
did she have a good positive legacy amongst
She did, because she was basically the our first woman president. From a third world country, because, you know, that would never happen here in the United States, I think.
it hasn't happened yet.
Did get a black man in.
Hopefully.
That's some accomplishment.
Hopefully little Gracie would be the president, the first woman president of the United States.
I wouldn't wish that job on her, but that's a separate story.
A lot of people pinned, a lot of hope on her, and it's a lot of, she tried to fulfill her and the change. Actually, one of the changes that happened was she closed down the Subic Bay, which is an American
military base.
Yeah, it's a big military base. But I was already here in the United States when that happened.
Yeah, Subic. I mean, just for people who are unfamiliar with Philippine politics, in brief, Marcos, of course, was supported by the U.S. and he was exiled along with his wife, famous wife, in her shoes down to Hawaii. Reagan let them in, and she did. Also, one thing that Aquino did do was she did strip the presidency, of which Marcos had gained so much power legally. She did delegalize all those things and stripped all preceding presidents after her, presidents that followed her. So that was one thing she did do. If she didn't accomplish, she had a lot to deal with after, you know, how many decades of Marcos rule.
Yes, over two decades.
So,
but I was at the People's Revolution. I was.
Tell us what that was like. What did it look like? What did it sound like? What did people wear? What happened? Tell us what happened.
Everybody was wearing yellow, and people put yellow ribbons in anything, pretty much. My friends, Hazel and Iris that I grew up with right next door to us in Taytay, we asked to go there, and it was a drive. There was no buses really. And we were really young. I was turning 16 and I actually celebrated my birthday there. And, their father had driven us there and we stayed there. We stayed there. She would not let us stay there overnight, but a lot of people were sleeping in the streets in EDSA, which is a huge boulevard. It's like Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right in front of, I can't remember the name of the camp, that was the base of the military in Manila. Mm-hmm. So, that was really cool. And just to be with all the people. And I was there when Marcos left Manila and went to Hawaii.
Well, I remember just from, you know, being a stupid kid in New York, like being like, God, Corazon Aquino, like, go for the Philippines. I'm like, that's pretty hardcore, you know? Like, as you said, it'll probably never happen, but it did happen. This was a kind of weird, the Asia Pacific New York Times, Corazon Aquino, ex-leader of Philippines, is dead. Like, that didn't seem very...
No, she was huge. She meant a great deal. And talk about it, to Patrick's question earlier, which is pretty interesting, Doyle, there was another... You guys, after you were here, but your family, half your family is still there, and your friends, of course, talking about Estrada, how that revolution happened, how they got him out of office, which is a pretty interesting technology. Technology really comes east from the east to the States. Tell us how that revolution happened.
Well, they used the Philippines had been, using text messages for as long as I can remember, and it's sort of like a Twitter thing. But they used their text messages, and that's how people came on the street and used the same thing that technology, which is actually pretty amazing at the time because, you know, back then like nobody was using any text messages, not even here, and mm-hmm. I don't think it was even offered. You know, in like any telephone plan with Verizon or anybody, mm-hmm. but that's what they used. They used
their
technology.
That's how they were able to communicate.
Yes, and they were able to get all the students and employees, workers, and everybody out in the street.
And this is for Joseph Estrada.
Yes.
They're Reagan, basically. He was said he was an actor, a famous actor.
He was a famous
took office.
Action here. Action.
More like Schwarzenegger, maybe, right?
Yeah.
And he and people were upset with the corruption, and the police couldn't follow it because the texting was so fast between the people. They just got out there before the police could do anything.
Yeah, right? They wanted to do another people power, and they're still doing the same thing because they feel like that was such a powerful thing that that the people power and the time that Corazon Aquino became president, that they wanted to use the same thing. And it, he was in jail, and I think he just came out, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he did. He's going back to the movies.
Going back into movies, is he?
He's a very old man now.
Well, Doyle, thank you so much for talking to us. It was nice to have someone actually from the Philippines talk about that. We always like to cover stories exactly 2 weeks after they happen. but then someone else died, John Hughes, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club. I mean, I missed so many seminal movies, but those two I caught, and like they had big significance.
Gigantic. I mean, he was huge. He always makes a joke because I remember seeing Breakfast Club as a kid. I was a teenager. It was like perfect. Weird Science, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I mean, come on. Like made Matthew Broderick. I mean, those were fantastic films. And I just remember thinking like how perfect. And he always says how like he had such a happy childhood growing up. And he died this week of a heart attack, 59 years old. Just total shock. He wrote Vacation, Pretty in Pink.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off he directed. Yeah, I mean, that's a great...
You know, one of my favorite ones that people don't talk about all the time is Uncle Buck. Do you remember that movie with
John Candy?
John Candy. He was kind of like the fat, drunk, smoking uncle who takes care of the kids, and the kids can't stand him. And he's got to get all the kids out of trouble. It's fantastic. And he just had, I don't know what it was, but John Hughes just had a touch, and it just spoke to a lot of kids, I think. And of course, the famous Brat Pack was...
He directed the Brat Pack, right?
Yeah, for a lot of the films. I mean, they came out, obviously, all the people, Emilio Estevez, Molly Ringwald was his girl, poor Judd...
Judd Nelson.
Judd Nelson, wherever he is now.
Anthony Michael Hall.
Anthony Michael
right?
Hall, right, exactly.
Matthew Broderick, wasn't like John Cusack and Joan Cusack?
Joan Cusack, yeah. I guess they were sort of in it.
I like Joan Cusack a lot.
They're great. Yeah, I love both of them. They're fantastic. Love the Cusacks.
Anyway, so, and then of course, your favorite also, Mark, Curly Sue. No, I don't know. Which one was that?
I don't know, Curly Sue.
Anyway, very sad that he passed away, but this has been a very interesting show. We had two Collins, two dogs, two Collins, Clay Gregory.
We want to thank Wes and Red for being in the studio. Patrick's two Scotty Terriers.
And who are
very well behaved, as is Doily, very well behaved.
Yeah, you were very well behaved, Doily. Thank you for coming and shedding some light on that. I'm going to be gone next week. Are you guys doing a show?
I will be here.
What's the show? Water?
We're still in process of making it, but tune in. It'll always be interesting coming together at the last minute, as it always does.
Stay tuned for who the sponsor is going to be next week. This week it was Paradise Locker Meats.
Yeah.
Also, we're going to have some new sound effects next week.
Awesome. Crank.
Hold on. Let's see.
We haven't had any this week.
I know. You know. There's one. All right. We'll be back next week.
Thanks,
and
guys.
Stay tuned to Heritage Radio Network, Cutting the Curd at 3:30 with Ann Saxelby.
Thanks.
We'll be right back.